leave any witnesses, and especially we can't leave any native stock of the species we stole. Honestly, where do you people get such ideas?
From books, Lark almost answered. From the warnings of our ancestors.
But indeed, how well could those accounts be trusted?
The most detailed had been lost to fire soon after humans arrived. Anyway, weren't humans naive newcomers on the galactic scene back in those days, worried to the point of paranoia? And wasn't it the most paranoic who had boarded the tabernacle, smuggling themselves to a far forbidden world to hide? Might the danger be exaggerated?
Seriously, Lark, why should we fear anything a bunch of Sooners might say about us? The odds of another Institute inspection team arriving at Jijo in under 100,000 years are very small. By the time one does, if any of you are still around, our visit will surely have dissolved into vague legends. We have no need to commit genocide, as if we could ever bring ourselves to do such a horrid thing, however strong the reason.
For the first time, Lark saw beyond Ling's normal mask of wry sardonicism. Either she deeply believed what she was saying, or she was a very skilled actress.
Well, then, how do you plan to adopt any pre-sentient species you find here? Surely you can't admit you picked them up on a restricted world.
At last, an intelligent question.
She seemed relieved.
I confess it won't be easy. They must be planted in another ecosystem, for starters, along with any symbionts they need, and other evidence to imply they've been there for some time. Then we must wait quite a while.
1,000,000 years? Ling's smile returned thinly.
Not quite that long. We have a couple of advantages going for us, you see. One is the fact that on most worlds the bio-record is a jumble of phylogenic anomalies. Despite rules to minimize harmful cross-flow, each time a new starfaring clan wins tenant rights to a world, they inevitably bring in their favorite plants and animals, along with a host of parasites and other hangers-on. Take Glavers, for instance.
She nodded over at the subject.
I'm sure we'll find records of places where similar genes flowed in the past.
Now it was Lark's turn to smile briefly.
You don't know the half of it.
So, you see, Ling went on, it won't matter much if a residual population stays on Jijo, as long as we have time to modify the borrowed stock, artificially enhancing the apparent rate of genetic divergence. And that will happen anyway when we begin the process of uplift.
So, Lark realized, even if the forayers eventually find Glavers unsuitable, they might still make off with some other promising species and turn a nice profit from their crime. Moreover, they appeared completely comfortable seeing it as no crime at all.
And your other advantage? He asked.
Ah, now that's the real secret.
A shine seemed to enter the woman's dark eyes.
You see, what it really comes down to is a matter of skill.
Skill?
On the part of our blessed patrons.
Now her words struck a reverent tone.
The Rothan are past masters at this art, you see. Witness their greatest success so far, the human race.
There it was again. Mention of the mysterious clan that had the utter devotion of Ling, Ron, and the others. The Starhumans had started out reticent. Ling had even made it clear that Rothan was not their real name. But with time, she and the others grew more talkative, as if their pride could not be contained. Or else, because they had no fear, the tale would spread.
Imagine! They managed to uplift humanity in complete secrecy, subtly altering the records of the Migration Institute so that our home world, Earth, remained untouched, on fallow status, for an incredible 500 million years. They even kept their gentle guidance unknown to our own ancestors, leaving them with the fantastic but useful illusion that they were uplifting themselves.
Amazing, Lark commented. He had never seen Ling so animated. He wanted to ask, how could such feats be feasible? But that might imply he doubted her, and Lark wanted this openness to continue. Of course, self-uplift is impossible, he prompted.
Completely. It's been known since the fabled days of the progenitors. Evolution can bring a species all the way up to pre-sapience, but the final leap needs help from another race that's already made it. This principle underlies the life cycle of all oxygen-breathing races in the 5 galaxies.
So why did our ancestors believe they raised themselves up?
Oh, the most insightful always suspected we had help from beyond. It explains the depth of feeling underlying most religions. But the true source of our gift of sapiency remained mysterious for most of the time. That hidden hands guided our path. Only the Danakites, early precursors of our group, knew the secret all along.
Even the Terrigan's Council.
The Terrigan's Council!
Her voice soured.
The idiots guiding Earth and her colonies during these dangerous times? Their obstinacy hardly matters. Even this streaker business, sending half the fanatics in the universe into a frenzy, howling for Earthling blood, even this will come out all right, despite the Terrigan's fools. The Rothan will see to things. Don't worry.
Lark hadn't been worried, not on the scale she referred to, not till that moment. Now he found her words anything but reassuring. From other conversations with the Danic sky humans, the sages had already pieced together hints that some great crisis was setting the 5 galaxies in an uproar. It might even explain why the Gene Raiders were here right now, taking advantage of the turmoil to do a little burglary.
What could a feeble clan of Earthlings have done to cause such commotion?
Lark wondered. With some effort, he pushed the thought aside as much too vast to be grappled with right now.
When did the Rothan reveal the truth to you, Danakites? Longer back than you might think, Lark. Even before your ancestors headed off in their creaky junkyard starship, taking their foolish wild gamble in coming to this world— Soon after, humanity entered interstellar space. A few men and women were chosen by the Rothan to receive the word. Those who had already been keeping faith, holding steadfast vigil. Some stayed on Earth to help guide the race in secret, while others went off to dwell in joy among the Rothan, aiding them in their work.
And what work is that?
She had a look, Lark sometimes saw, on the faces of those returning from pilgrimages to the egg, on those blessed occasions when the sacred stone sang its serene harmonies, an expression of having experienced splendor. Why, rescuing the lost, of course, and nurturing what might yet be.
Lark worried she might drift into complete mysticism.
Will we get to meet some Rothan?
Her eyes had defocused while pondering vistas of time and space. Now they turned and glittered sharply.
Some of you may, if you are lucky. In fact, a few of you may get luckier than you ever dreamed.
Her implication set his head awhirl. Could she mean what he thought she meant? That evening, by candlelight, he went over his calculations one more time. From our best measurements, the starship had a volume of about 500,000 cubic meters. If you stacked every human on Jijo like frozen cordwood, we just might fit, providing you left no room for anything else. The first time he had worked out the numbers, his intent was simply to dispel rumors among some younger Urs and Kewans that the human settlers would soon abandon Jijo. It was physically impossible, he showed, for the youngest sept to forsake the commons for a ticket back to the stars, at least with this ship alone. But she had said, "Some of you." Even after loading aboard hundreds of Wuonk worms, long snouts, or glavers, there'd still be room for a few lost cousins, those who had proved useful. Lark knew a bribe when he heard one. Much as he condemned the ancestors' choice to come here, Lark loved this world. He would feel a pang if he ever left, and for all his days thereafter. Yet if things were different, I'd go in a shot. Who wouldn't? The zealots are right. No human can be completely trusted these days, not when any of us might be suborned, bought with an offer to be made into a god. In fact, he had no idea what the zealots planned, only that they felt free to act without advice or approval from the dithering sages. There were humans in the cabal, of course. What could be accomplished without earthling skill and lore? But men and women were excluded from the inner circle. So what have I learned? He looked down at a blank sheet. Surely the sages and zealots had other feelers out. Even Harulan must be hedging his bets. Still, Lark knew his words carried weight. If Ling is telling the truth and the zealots believe it, they might call off whatever action they planned. What do they care if a few glavers or rock stallers are taken off planet, so long as the intruders leave us in peace, as we were before? But what if Ling was lying? Might the zealots lose their best chance to strike for nothing? On the other hand, suppose no one believed Ling, but she really was telling the truth. The zealots might attack and fail, only to goad the very response they feared. At the opposite extreme of radicalism from the fiery zealots, some of the most radical heretics actually favored their own destruction along with the rest of the six. Some Hoon and Urs members of Harulan society yearned for a time of transcendent ending, the Urish apostates because of their hot blood, and the Hoon precisely because their passion stirred slowly, but once whipped, they stopped for nothing. If our extremists think Ling's folk haven't the guts to do the job, they may plot to provoke genocide. This, despite his speech, urging that the six cede their place on Jijo by consensus and birth control. Then there was this scheme to try blackmailing the forayers. Lark had helped Bloor set up candid shots, but were the sages aware of how the scheme might backfire? Did they think they had nothing to lose? Lark rubbed his stubbled chin, feeling wearier than his years. "What a tangled web we weave," he pondered. Then he licked the tip of his pen, dipped it in the ink, and began to write. The Stranger. This place makes him want to laugh. It makes him want to cry. So many books. He even remembers that word for them, lay stacked high all around him, in row after mighty row, vanishing around corners or up twisty spiral ramps. Books bound in the leather of unknown animals, filling the air with strange scents, especially when he cracks some volume taken off a shelf at random and inhales the fumes of paper and ink. It jolts something within him, dredging up memories more effectively than anything since he regained consciousness. Suddenly, he recalls a cabinet of books like these in his room when he was very young. And that brings back the pinch and crinkling flecks of paper pages covered with bright pictures. Grown-ups did not use books very much, he remembers. Adults needed the constant flash and jangle of their machines, machines that talked at you faster than a child was trained to hear, or cast flickering beams directly at the eyeball, filling it with facts that faded the moment you blinked. That was one reason he used to like the solid promise of paper, where a favorite story would not go away like smoke or vanish when the info screens went dark. Another image leaps out from childhood, holding his mother's hand while strolling in a public place filled with busy, important people. Several walls were rimmed with bound volumes, much like the books surrounding him right now. Big books without pictures, filled with black, unmoving dots, filled with words and nothing else. Hardly anyone used them anymore, his mother had explained, but they were important nonetheless as decorations lining many of the places most sacred or important to human beings. They were reminders of something. Of something he cannot quite recall right now, but it must have been important. That much he knows. Patiently, he waits for the two women, Sarah and Arianafu, to finish their meetings and return for him. Passing the time, he sketches on a pad of rich, almost luminous paper, first refining some of his drawings of the machinery aboard the steamship, then trying to capture the eerie perspectives of the stone cavern where all these odd wooden buildings lay sheltered from the sky, under a cave whose roof is propped up by incredible, massive stone pillars. A few names are coming easier now, so he knows that it is Pretty who brings him a cup of water, then checks his dressing to make sure it's still tight. Her hands seem to flutter and dance before her, then his do likewise. He watches, fascinated, as his own fingers make movements independent of his will or command. It might be frightening to behold, except that Pretty suddenly grins broadly and slaps her knee, chuffing, hoarse, appreciative, chimpanzee laughter. He feels a wash of pleasure to know his joke had pleased her, though it puzzles and slightly miffs him that his hands never saw fit to share the humor with him. Well, the hands seem to know what they are doing, and he draws some satisfaction from their work. Now they pick up the pencil once again, and he lets time slip away, concentrating on the moving pencil and on the stretch and tilt of line and shadow. When Sarah returns for him, he will be ready for whatever comes next. Perhaps it might even be possible to find a way to save her and her people. Maybe that was what his hands had said to Pretty just a little while ago. If so, no wonder the little chimp broke out in wry, doubtful laughter. Part 17. The Book of the Sea. Should you succeed in following the path of redemption, to be readopted, uplifted anew, given a second chance, that will not mean an end to all your strivings. For you must prove yourselves as noble clients, obedient and true to the new patrons who redeemed you. Later you will rise in status and uplift clients of your own, generously passing on the blessings that you earned. But then, in time, there oft begins to glimmer a light on the horizon of a species' life, hinting at other realms, beckoning the tired, the worthy. This is said to be a signpost. Some will call it the lure, or else the enticement. Eon after eon, old ones depart, seeking paths that younger races can't perceive. They vanish from our midst, those who find these paths. Some call it transcendence. Others call it death. The Scroll of Destiny. Alvin's Tale.
One thing always struck me about the way tales are told in Anglic, or any of the other earthling tongues I've learned, and that's the problem of keeping up suspense. Oh, some human authors of Twinson and 21 had it down cold. There have been times that I stayed up 3 nights straight, taken with some yarn by Conrad or Cunnan. What's puzzled me ever since I got the notion of becoming a writer myself is how those old-timers managed it. Take this account I've been scribbling lately. Whenever I get a chance to lie down on this hard deck with my notebook, already gone all ragged at the corners from the places I've taken it, scrawling clumsy, hoon-sized letters with a chewed-up pencil clutched in my fist. From the very start, I've been telling my story in first person, like in a diary, only with all sorts of fancy gloss tricks thrown in that I've picked up from my reading over the years. Why first person? Well, according to Good Fiction by Anderson, that voice makes it a whole lot easier to present the reader with a single, solid feeling point of view, even though it means my book will have to be translated if a Treyiki's ever to understand it. But the trouble with the first-person chronicle is this. Whether it's real-life history or a piece of make-believe, you know the hero survived. So during all the events I'm about to relate, you who are reading this memoir, hopefully after I've had a chance to rewrite it, have a human expert fix my grammar, and pay to have it set in type, you already know that I, Alvin Hoofweo, son of Mufalk and Yaugweo of Wufonport, and intrepid explorer extraordinaire, simply have to escape alive the jam I'm about to describe with at least one brain, one eye, and a hand to write it all down. I've lain awake some nights trying to see a way around this problem using some other language. There's the Gal 7 tentative case, for instance, but that doesn't work in past explicit tense. And the quantum uncertain declension in Bayer dialect Gal 3 is just too weird. Anyway, who would I be writing for? Huck's the only other Gal 3 reader I know, and getting praise from her is kind of like kissing your sister. Anyway, the waters of the rift were all a froth at the point where I last left our tale. The hatchet shadow of Terminus Rock cut across a patch of ocean, where both hawser and hose still whirred, chopping the normally placid surface, spinning with tension energy released just moments before by a disaster.
It was all too easy to picture what had happened to Wufan's dream, our little vessel for exploring the great unknown below. In reluctant imagining, I saw the hollow wooden tube, its wheels spinning uselessly, the bulbous glass nose broken, tumbling into black emptiness, trailing its broken leash, carrying Ziz, the little Treiki partial stack, to perdition along with it. As if that weren't enough, we all had fresh in memory the sight of little Hufu, our Noor beast mascot, thrown by the recoiling crane, screeching and gyrating till her tiny black figure vanished into the blue waters of the rift. As Huck's earthling nicknamesake might have said, "It warn't a happy sight, nor a lucky one." For a long time, everybody just stared. I mean, what could we do? Even the protesters from Wufan Port and the Vale were silent. If any felt smug over our comeuppance as heretics, they felt wiser to withhold jubilation. We all backed away from the ledge. What point in peering at a velvety smooth grave?
"Retract the hawser and hose," Erdonald commanded.
Soon the drums began rotating the other way, rewinding what had unreeled so hopefully just Duras before. The same hoonish voice called out depths, only this time the numbers grew steadily smaller, and there was no great booming enthusiasm in the throaty baritone. Finally, at 2.5 cables, the hawser's frayed end popped out of the sea, dripping water like a white, limp fluid from a Treiki's wounded, dangling tentacle. Those cranking the drums sped up, eager to see what had happened.
"Acid vein," Uron declared in shock,
when the severed end was swung onto the bluff. She lisped in anger.
"Savutage."
Erdonald seemed reluctant to leap to conclusions, but the older Ur's technician kept swinging her narrow head back and forth, low and snake-like, from the burn cable to the crowd of protesters standing on the bluff, gaping at our tragedy. The Urish apprentice's dark suspicion was clear.
"Get away from here!"
Huck shouted angrily, rolling toward the dissenters, spinning up gravel with her rims. She swerved, just missing the toes of several humans and Hoon, who backed off nervously. Even a couple of Reds withdrew their clawed, armored legs, scuttling away a pace or two, before recalling that a flail-eyed Gekek isn't much physical threat to a Cowan. Then they moved forward again, hissing and clicking. Pincer and I rushed to Huck's side. It might have gotten ugly, but then a bunch of big grays and burly Urish smiths from Mount Gwen Forge hurried up behind us, some carrying cudgels, ready to back up Huck's demand with angry force. The rabble took note and quit our worksite, moving toward their makeshift camp.
"Bastards!"
Huck cursed after them.
"Horrid cheeky murderers!"
Not by law, I thought, still numb from shock. Neither Hufu nor little Ziz had strictly been citizens of the commons, nor even honorary ones like glaivers or members of any threatened species. So it wasn't murder exactly, but close enough by my reckoning. My hands clenched, and I sensed something give as my back flexed with fight hormones. Anger is slow to ignite in a Hoon and hard to snuff once lit. It's kind of disturbing to look back on how I felt then. Even though the sages say what you feel isn't evil, only what you do about it. No one said a word. We must have moped for a while, Erdonnell and Urron argued over what kind of a message to send to Uriel. Then a stuttering whistle pierced our pit of mourning, coming from behind us toward the sea. We turned to see Pincertip teetering bravely at the edge, blowing dust as he piped shrilly from three leg vents while motioning with two claws for us to come back.
"Look, Ukuk," came his aspirated stammer. "Huck, Alvin, hurry!"
Huck claimed later she realized right off what Pincer must have seen. I guess in retrospect it is kind of obvious, but at the time I had no idea what could have him so excited. On reaching the edge, I could only peer down in amazement at what had popped out of the belly of the rift. It was Arbathy. Our beautiful Wufon's dream floated upright, almost peaceful in the bright sunshine. And on its curved top sat a small black figure, wet and bedraggled from nose to tail. It didn't take a Gekex vision to tell that our little Noor was as amazed to be alive as we were to see her. Faint whispers of her yelping complaint floated up to us.
"But how?" Erdonnell began.
"Of course," Urron interrupted. "The Valist can lose."
I blinked a couple of times.
"Oh, the ballast! Hrum! Yes, the dream'd be buoyant without it. But there was no crew to pull the release unless—"
"Unless Ziz did it,"
Huck finished for me.
"Insufficient explanation,"
Erdonnell interjected in Gal, too.
"With 8 cables of heavy down-seeking metal hawser weighing the diving device, the minuscule air pocket within our vessel ought to have been decisively overwhelmed."
"Hrum, I think I see what made the difference," I suggested, shading my eyes with both hands. "Huck, what is that thing surrounding the bathy?" Again our wheeled friend teetered at the edge, spreading 2 eye stalks far apart and sticking out a third for good measure.
"It looks like a balloon of some sort, Alvin. A tube wrapped around the dream like a life preserver. A circular Ziz!"
That matched my own guess. A Traiki torus inflated beyond anything we might have thought possible. Everybody turned to stare at Teug, the Mount Gwen master of mixes. The full-sized Traiki shuddered, letting out a colored cloud that smelled like released tension.
"A precaution, one that we contemplated in consultation with our Lord Uriel. A safeguard of unknown, untried efficacy. Glad we are to have lent a success. These rings and those below anticipate relishing recent events soon, in retrospect."
"In other words, Erds," Pincer interrupted, "stop staring like a bunch of day-blind glavers. Let's go fetch 'em back, Akak."
Part 18. The Book of the Slope. Legends. It is said that earlier generations interpreted the scrolls in ways quite different than we do now, in our modern commons. Without doubt, each wave of immigrants brought to the slope a new crisis of faith, from which beliefs emerged, restructured, changed. At the start, every fresh arrival briefly held advantages, bearing godlike tools from the 5 galaxies. Newcomers kept these powers for intervals ranging from a few months to more than 8 years. This helped each sept establish a secure base for their descendants, as humans did at Byblos, the Hoon on Hoff Island, and the Gekek at Duden Mesa. Yet each also knew its handicaps, a small founding population and ignorance about how to live a primitive existence on an unknown world. Even the haughty gray queens conceded they must accept certain principles, or risk vendetta from all the others combined. The Covenant of Exile set rules of population control, concealment, and Jijo preservation, as well as proper ways to handle dross. These fundamentals continue to this day. It is all too easy to forget that other matters were settled only after mordant struggle. For instance, bitter resistance to the reintroduction of metallurgy by Urish smiths was only partly based on Kewans protecting their tool monopoly. There was also a sincere belief on the part of many Hoon and Treyiki that the innovation was sacrilege. To this day, some on the slope will not touch reforged Buyer steel or let it in their villages or homes, no matter how many times the sages rule it safe for temporary use. Another remnant belief can be seen among those Puritans who despise books. While paper itself can hardly be faulted, it decays well and can be used to reprint copies of the scrolls, there is still a dissident minority who call the Byblos Trove a vanity at best, and an impediment to those whose goal should lie in blessed ignorance. In the early days of human life on Jijo, such sentiments were exploited by Urish and Kewan foes, until the great smiths discovered profit in the forging of type, and book addiction spread unstoppably throughout the commons. Strangely, it is the most recent crisis of faith that shows the least leftover effects today. If not for written accounts, it would be difficult to believe that only a century ago there were many on the slope who loathed and feared the newly arrived holy egg. Yet at the time, there were serious calls for the Explosers Guild to destroy it, to demolish the stone that sings, lest it give away our hiding place, or worse, distract the six away from following the same path already blazed by Glaivers. If it is not in the scrolls, it cannot be sacred. That has always been the declaration of orthodoxy since time immemorial, and to this day it must be confessed. There is no mention in the scrolls of anything even remotely like the egg. Ready. Dark, clammy, stifling. Reddy didn't like the cave. It must be the stale, dusty air that made her heart pound so, or else the painful scrapes on her legs after sliding down a twisty chute to this underground grotto from a narrow entrance in a boo-shrouded cleft. Or maybe what made her jumpy was the way shapes kept crowding in from all sides. Each time Reddy whirled with her borrowed lantern, the creepy shadows turned out to be knobs of cold, dead rock. But a little voice seemed to say, "Always. So far. But a real monster may wait around the next bend." She set her jaw and refused to listen. Anyone who called her scared would be a liar. Does a scared person slink into dark places at night? Or do things they was told not to do by all the big fat chiefs of the six? A weight wriggled in her belt pouch. Reddy reached past the fur-lined flap to stroke the squirming creature. "Don't spook ye. It's just a big hole in the ground." A narrow head and a sinuous neck snaked toward her, three eyes glittering in the soft flamelight. A squeaky voice protested.
"Ye not spooked. Dark good. On plains, lil manners love hidey holes, till find warm wife."
"Okay, okay, I didn't mean—"
"Ye help, nervous wife."
"Who are you calling nervous, you little—"
Reddy cut short. Maybe she should let Ye feel needed, if it helped him keep his own fear under control.
"Ow, not so tight,"
the male yelped, echoes fleeing down black corridors. Reddy quickly let go and stroked Yee's ruffled mane.
"Sorry. Look, I bet we're getting close, so let's not talk so much, okay?"
"Okay. Ye shove up. Wife do too."
Reddy's lips pressed. Then anger flipped into a sudden urge to laugh. Whoever said male urs weren't smart must have never met her husband. Ye had even changed his accent in recent days, mimicking Reddy's habits of speech. She raised the lantern and resumed picking her way through the twisty cavern, surrounded by a sparkle of strange mineral formations, reflecting lamplight off countless glittering facets. It might have been pretty to look at if she weren't obsessed with one thing alone, an item to reclaim, something she once briefly had owned. "My ticket off this mud ball." Reddy's footprints appeared to be the first ever laid in the dust, which wasn't surprising, since just Kellens and a few humans and Urs had a knack for travel underground, and she was smaller than most. With luck, this tunnel led toward the much larger cave she had seen Lester Campbell enter several times. Following the chief human sage had been her preoccupation, while avoiding the group of frustrated men and women who wanted her to help guide them over the mountains. Once she knew for sure where Campbell spent his evenings, she had sent Ye scouring the underbrush till he found this offshoot opening, bypassing the guarded main entrance. The little guy was already proving pretty darn useful. To Reddy's surprise, married life wasn't so bad, once you got used to it. There was more tight wriggling and writhing. At times she had to squirm sideways or slide down narrow chutes, making Ye complain when he got squeezed. Beyond the lantern's dim yellow puddle, she heard soft tinkling sounds as water dripped into black pools, slowly sculpting weird underground shapes out of Jijo's raw mineral juices. With each step, Reddy fought a tightness in her chest, trying to ignore her tense imagination, which pictured her in the twisty guts of some huge slumbering beast. The rocky womb kept threatening to close in from all sides, shutting the exits, then grinding her to dust. Soon the way narrowed to a corkscrew horizontal tube that was tight even for her. She had to send Ye ahead before attempting the contorted passage, pushing the lantern along in front of her. Yi's tiny hooves clattered on gritty limestone. Soon she heard a welcome hoarse whisper.
"He's good. Hole opens up. Little ways more. Come, wife, faster."
His chiding almost made her snort angrily. Not a wise idea with her cheek, nose, and mouth scraping rank dust. Contorting her body to turn the next corner, she suddenly felt certain the walls were moving. She recalled what Dwer's brother had said about this region when he led her down that last stretch to the glade, past steaming sulfur vents. Lark had called this a land of earthquakes and seemed to think it a good thing. Twisting uneasily, her hip jammed in a stone cleft.
"I'm caught."
thought of entrapment sent a whimpering moan surging past flecked lips as she thrashed, banging her knee agonizingly. The world really was closing in. Her forehead struck stone, and pain dazzles swarmed her dimming vision. The candle lantern rattled from her clutching fingertips, almost toppling over.
"Easy, wife. Stop. Stay."
The words bounced off the warped mirror of her panic. Stubbornly, Reddy kept striving against cold stone, groaning and pushing futilely, until something clicked inside her. All at once, she went limp, suddenly resigned to let the mountain do whatever it wanted with her. Moments after she stopped fighting, the walls miraculously seemed to stop moving. Or had it been her all along?
"Better now? Good, good. Now, move left leg. Left. Good. Stop now. Okay, roll other way. Good, wife."
His tiny voice was a lifeline she clutched for a few duras, for the eternity that it took to win free. At last, the clutch of the stony passage eased, and she slithered down a sandy bank in a flowing, almost liquid liberation that felt just like being born. When next she looked up, Yi had the lantern cradled in both arms, bowing with four legs bent.
"Good, brave wife. No wife ever like Yi's amazing wife."
This time, Reddy could not hold it in. She covered her mouth with both hands, yet her escaping laughter bounced off the fluted walls. Combed by stalactites, it came back as 100 soft echoes of her joy to be alive. The sage was pondering her bird. He peered at it, wrote on a notepad, then poked it with some shiny tool. Reddy seethed. The gold-green machine was hers. Hers! She had pursued it from the southern marshes to the Rimmers, rescued it from a greedy mulk spider, won it with her sweat, suffering, and dreams. She would choose who, if anybody, got to study it. Anyway, what was a savage shaman going to achieve with his crude glass lenses and such? The tools lying near the bird might have impressed the old Reddy, who thought Dwar's hunting bow was so great. But all that changed after meeting Besh, Ron, and the other star humans. Now she knew, despite all his airs, Lester Campbell was just like Jass or Baum, or any of the other idiots back in the Gray Hills. Stupid braggarts, bullies, always taking things that didn't belong to them. Under the bright flare of a mirrored oil lamp, Campbell flipped through a book. Its pages crackled as if they had not been turned in a very long time. Reddy couldn't make out much from her vantage point, perched on a cleft high up one craggy cavern wall. Not that she could read, anyway. Most of each page seemed to be taken up with drawings and lots of little crisscrossing lines. Nothing much resembled a bird. "Come on, Yi," she thought restlessly. "I'm counting on you." She was taking a big risk. The little male had assured her he could handle it. But what if he got lost while sneaking around to the other side? Or forgot his lines? Reddy would be furious if the little guy wound up getting hurt. Campbell's assistant stood up and left the chamber, perhaps on some brief errand, or else to retire for the night. Either way, this was a perfect time. "Come on, Yi." After so long writhing through dark passages, always fearful the little candle would go out, Reddy found the cool brilliance of the sage's lamp harsh to the eyes. With reluctance, she had blown out her own light while creeping the last few meters, lest its glow draw attention. Now she regretted it.
What if I have to retreat the way I came?
She couldn't willingly face that path again, but as a last resort, if someone were chasing her. Too bad she had no way to restart the candle.
Maybe I should have learned to use one of those match things the Slopies boast about.
She had been too awed by the sudden burst of flame to pay close attention when Dwyer and later Urjah tried showing how they worked. It was all the fault of Jas and Bomb, of course, who didn't like womenfolk controlling fire on their own.
"But fire's just fine for scaring or burning women, ain't it?"
she pondered angrily, touching her face.
"Maybe I'll come back some day, Jas. Maybe I'll bring another kind of fire."
Reddy re-entered her favorite fantasy, flying off to live with the sky humans on their home star. Oh, at first she'd start out as a sort of pet or mascot, but just give her time. She'd learn whatever it took in order to rise up until she became so important that some great Rothan prince would put a ship, a fleet of ships, at her command to go with her back to Jijo. It was fun picturing the look on Jas's smug, handsome face when the sky over Gray Hills went dark at noon, and then her words booming from above.
"Ye wise Mr. Human, sir!"
The tiny voice shook her back to the present. She saw it down below and spied Yi trotting nervously near the leg of Lester Campbell's chair.
What was that?" Campbell asked.
Yi jumped as the chair scraped back, pushed by the sage, who peered about in confusion.
"Message for wise human. Message from wise Grandma Urjah."
Now Campbell looked down, first amazed, then quizzically intrigued.
"Yes, small one? And how did you get down here past the guard?"
"Guard, he look out for danger. Look right past ye. Is ye danger?"
The tiny Urs laughed, mimicking Reddy's own nervous giggle. She hoped Campbell didn't recognize the similarity. The sage nodded gravely.
"No, I suppose not. Unless someone gets you angry, my friend, which I'll strive not to do. So now, what's this about a message at this time of night?"
Yi did a little dance with his hooves and lifted both arms dramatically.
"Urgent time for talk-talk. Look at dead birdie later. Go, Urjah, now. Now!"
Reddy feared his vehemence would rouse suspicion, but the balding human put down his tools at once and stood up.
"Well, then, let's go."
Reddy's hopes soared, then sank as Campbell lifted the bird with both hands.
"No, put it down."
As if prodded by her tense mental urging, the sage paused, shook his head, and put the machine back, picking up his notebook instead.
"Lay on, Macduff," he said to Yi,
motioning with a sweep of one arm.
"Great sage says what?"
The small Urs tilted his head.
"I said, oh, never mind. An obscure illusion. Guess I'm just tired. Shall I carry you, sir?"
"No! Ye lead wise human. Walk this way, this way."
And he scampered off eagerly, pausing impatiently and backtracking several times as the sage followed ploddingly behind. When they both had vanished up the tunnel leading toward the main entrance, Reddy wasted no time slithering down the crumbly, slanting limestone wall till she tumbled bottom first onto the floor of the laboratory cave. She scrambled up and hurried to the table where her bird lay, headless as it had been ever since the fight with the alien Roban. Its breast lay spread open like a carcass at a feast, exposing innards like none Reddy had ever seen, glittering like jewels.
"What did the stinker do? Gut it like a herd chick?"
She fought to check her rage.
"Ron might not pay if the fools have ruined it by mucking inside."
She looked closer. The opening was too clean to have been hacked with a knife. In fact, when she hesitantly touched the bird's ribcage, it seemed to roll smoothly around the line where it was still connected, like the hinged door she had seen on a big cabinet and marveled at while visiting the forayer's medical tent.
"I see. You just close it like this."
She lifted the smaller section through an arc till it swung shut with a decisive click. Now, Reddy regretted her haste. There was no more chance to look closer at the little flashings inside.
"Oh, well, none of my business anyway," she thought, and plucked up her prize. "At least I don't pretend I'm anything but a sooner and a savage. Though not forever. Once I get off Jijo, I'll learn. I'll learn all right."
The bird was heavier than she recalled. Briefly, her heart felt full. She had her treasure back. She crammed the heavy bird thing into her pouch, bypassing the books strewn across the table, as she hurried off, following the same path Yi and Lester Campbell had taken, an easy stand-up trail leading toward the outside world. The way was lit by little lamps hanging from a thin boo pipe stapled to the wall. Tiny flames flickered an eerie blue color, leaving wide pools of shadow in between. Dim light also spilled from several side chambers, now mostly empty of workers as it was nighttime outside. One cell, however, seemed to blaze with bulky lanterns. Before tiptoeing past, Reddy warily eyed two human occupants, who were luckily turned away, murmuring with low voices. Drawings of the star gods, their aircraft, and other tools lay tacked on a dozen or so easels. The cube-shaped station, which Reddy had never seen unburied, lay revealed in fine detail, more grand than some shattered Boyer site. Yet it seemed minute next to the monstrous tube depicted on the next sketch, floating above the forest.
"My starship,"
she mused, though cowed by the thought of boarding the huge vessel when it returned for the forayers. She must remember to hold her chin up that day and show no fear. The artists had caught Ron's distant, amused gaze and Coon's sharp hunter's glare as he adjusted the claw arm of a hovering robot. The pale intensity of Besh balanced Ling's dusky, half-cynical expression. Reddy knew they were only drawings, like the ones some old grandpas used to scratch on a cliff overlooking the wintering cave back in the gray hills. Still, the lifelike accuracy seemed spooky and magical.
"The Slopies are studying the Starmen. What could it mean?"
Reddy almost tripped in her haste to get away.
"Whatever they are planning, it won't come to much."
She set her mind back to getting out of this place and making the rendezvous in time. The mustiness began to lift and the harsh echoes softened. Soon she heard voices ahead. Lester Campbell trading words with a second human. Reddy tiptoed to the next bend and peered around. The human sage could be seen talking to the cave guard, who looked down at Yi with a chagrined expression.
"Privacy, wasps may stop the tiniest robots," Campbell said. "But what about something the size of this little fellow?"
"Honestly, sir, I can't imagine how he got past."
Campbell waved off the apology.
There was no harm done this time, son. It's mostly their contempt that protects us. Their confidence we have nothing worth spying on. Just be more careful from now on, eh?
He patted the young man's arm and turned to follow as Yi hurried outside. The path seemed brightly lit by moonshine, piercing through gently waving forest branches. Still clearly perplexed, the guard set his jaw and gripped his weapon, a kind of pole with a sharp-looking knife thing at one end, standing with legs slightly apart at the center of the entrance. When the scrape of Campbell's footsteps faded, Reddy counted 20 duras, then made her own move. Faking calm, she sauntered toward the young guard, who swiveled when she was close. Reddy gave a smile and an easygoing wave.
"Well, guess I'm all done for the night."
She yawned, sidling past his bulk, sensing his startled indecision.
"Boy, I'll tell you, that science sure is hard work. Well, good night."
Now she was outside, gratefully inhaling fresh mountain air and trying not to break into a run. Especially when he shouted,
"Hey, stop right there!"
Swiveling around, but continuing to walk backward down the path, Reddy delayed him a few more seconds by grinning broadly.
"Yeah? You need something?"
"What? Who are you?"
"Got something here I figure the sage'd want to be seeing,"
she replied with deceptive truthfulness, patting her belt pouch and still backing away. The guard started toward her. With a joyful shout, Reddy spun about and took off into the forest, knowing pursuit was hopeless at this point. He had lost his chance, the stinker. Still, she was kind of glad that he tried. Yi met her where they had agreed, by the log bridge, halfway to the place where she was to join Ron. On spying her, the little Urs yelped and seemed to fly into her arms. He was less pleased on trying to burrow into his accustomed place, only to find a cold, hard object taking up the pouch. Reddy tucked him into the folds of her jacket, and after a moment he seemed to find that acceptable.
"Ye tell wife, ye see."
"We did it,"
Reddy chortled gleefully, unable to contain the rush of an adventure so well closed. The chase had been a perfect way to finish, leaping and laughing as she ran through the forest, leaving the big oaf to flounder in the dark, while she circled around, then slinked right past the noisy guard on her way back to the glade.
"You were great, too," she told Yi, sharing credit. "Would have been harder to do it without you."
She hugged his little body till he complained with a series of short grunts.
"Did you have any trouble getting away from Campbell?"
she asked.
"Wise man, human, no problem. Ye get way good, but then..."
"Great. Then it's over. We better go now, though. If Ron has to wait, he may not be in as good a mood as..."
"But then ye see something on way to meet wife. Whole herd of urs, kellens, horns, men, all going sneak, sneak in dark. Carry big boxes."
Reddy hurried down a side trail leading toward the rendezvous point.
"Do tell. Probably one of those silly pilgrim things heading up to pray to that big rock they think is a god."
She had only contempt for the superstitions of planet-grubbing Sooners. To her, all the talk she'd heard about the Slopies' fabulous egg was just more scare-you-in-the-dark stuff, like those tales of ghosts and huge beasts and spirit glavers that were common campfire fare back in the gray hills, especially since Jass and Bomb took over. Whenever times were hard, the hunters would argue into the night, seeking some reason why the prey animals might be angry and ways to appease them.
herd of sneakers not go holy rock.
Yi protested.
Heck wrong way. No white robes, no sing songs, just sneak, sneak, I say. Sneak with boxes to another cave.
Reddy's interest was almost piqued. Yi sure seemed to think it important. But just then the trail turned to overlook the little valley where the sky humans dwelled. Moonlight spilled across pavilions that seemed strangely less well camouflaged now in the vivid dimness. A soft hum warbled from the west, and a glint drew her eye as a glistening teardrop shape floated into view, folding away two delicate wings as it descended. Reddy felt a tingle, recognizing the small flying boat of the forayers, returning from another mysterious expedition. She watched transfixed as the lovely thing settled gracefully to the valley floor. A hole opened, swallowing it into the ground. Excitement filled Reddy's lungs, and her heart felt light.
"Hush, husband," she told Yi when he complained of being ignored. "We got some tradin' and dickerin' to do. Now's when we'll see if they pay what they promised."
Asks.
"My rings, you need not my weekly focused musings to inform you. Surely all of you must feel it deep within each oily torus core. The egg, slowly as if rising from a deep torpor, it wakens. Perhaps now the commons will be filled once more with comity, with union of spirit, with the meshed resolve that once bound jointly our collective wills. Oh, let it be so. We are so fractured, so far from ready, so far from worthy. Oh, let it be so."
Sarah. The stacks were infested with polisher bees, and the music rooms thronged with hungry, biting parrot fleas, but the chimps on the maintenance staff were too busy to fumigate for minor pests. While taking some air in the west atrium, Sarah watched several of the hairy workers help a human librarian pack precious volumes into fleece-lined crates, then seal them with drippings from a big red candle. Gobbets of wax clung to the chimp's matted fur, and they complained to each other with furtive hand signs.
"This is not correct," Sarah interpreted one worker's flurry of gestures and husky grunts. "In this intemperate haste, we are making regrettable errors."
The other replied, "How true, my associate. This volume of Auden should not go in among Greek classics. We shall never get these books properly restacked when this crisis finally blows over, as surely it must." Well, perhaps she was generous in her mental translation. Still, the chimps who labored in these hallowed halls were a special breed, almost as special as pretty. Overhead towered the atrium of the Hall of Literature, spanned by bridges and ramps that linked reading rooms and galleries, all lined with shelves groaning under the weight of books, absorbing sound while emitting a redolence of ink, paper, wisdom, and dusty time. Weeks of frantic evacuation, hauling donkey loads to faraway caves, had not made a dent in the hoard, still crammed with texts of every color and size. Sage Plavov called this hall, dedicated to legend, magic, and make-believe, the House of Lies. Yet Sarah always felt this place less burdened by the supremacy of the past than in those nearby structures dedicated to science. After all, what could Jijo's savages ever add to the mountain of facts brought here by their godlike ancestors? A mountain said to be like a sand grain next to the great galactic library. But the tales in this hall feared no refutal by ancient authority. Good or bad, great or forgettable, no work of literature was ever provably false. Plavov said, "It's easy to be original when you don't have to care whether you're telling the truth. Magic and art arise